Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. On this show, a look back. Over the last dozen or 15 years, we've been fortunate enough to interview people who've held responsibility for American foreign policy at very high levels. Robert McNamara served as Secretary of Defense to President Kennedy. Henry Kissinger served as Secretary of State under President Nixon. And Condoleezza Rice, of course, served as Secretary of State under President George W. Bush. For this program, we've gone into our archives and selected excerpts that display the three persons' different personalities, different approaches to American foreign policy, even different management techniques. But as you listen to these excerpts, I think you'll be struck by one constant. Robert McNamara, Henry Kissinger, and Condoleezza Rice all believe that the United States possesses a particular responsibility in the world. You mentioned physical security. At that point, you mentioned in no higher honor that the one time you raised your voice to the President of the United States was when he was in Florida. He'd just been informed of a terrorist attack.
Yes.
His impulse was to come back to Washington,
right.
And you said?
I said, I did something I never did again and had never done before. I raised my voice to the President of the United States. I said, stay where you are. You can't come back here. I said, the United States is under attack. And he did stay, of course, and went to an undisclosed location. And I went then to the bunker because the Secret Service, when the Secret Service wants to lead you someplace, they don't so much as lead you as they sort of pick you up and push you in that direction. That day meant that every other day was going to be September 12th.
What did the Bush administration get right and what did it get wrong as one thinks about what McCain or Hillary or Obama will find himself facing?
I think the Bush administration got right from the beginning the nature of the threat, that we were facing an assault that went beyond the 9/11 attack that represented a fundamental philosophical and strategic challenge to the United States. They also got right that it could not be defeated in any one place. Then some of the specific steps they took, I had a different view on.
Right. With Russia. Why should Russia feel betrayed?
I don't want to say they should feel betrayed, but why should they feel concerned, let me put it that way,
all right,
at risk with respect to the West? Not just the U.S., but the West. Because we have expanded NATO, and we're talking about expanding it a second time, a military alliance moved eastward to their very borders. And it also, they believed that we had stated we would not do that. And that was part of the deal, they thought, for integrating East and West Germany, which they approved at the end of the Cold War. And today we're talking about bringing the Baltic states in. Now, I'm not arguing they're right. Please don't misunderstand me. What I'm arguing is we've got to think about the way the Russians look at the West.
The long view. In his recent book, World War IV, Norman Podhoretz writes about the extreme difficulty of attempting to prosecute the war in Vietnam in the face of elite opinion that was hostile to that war, something about which you're an expert. Administrators, bureaucrats, the entire apparatus in Washington, Norman writes, quote, all they needed to do was read the New York Times or switch on their television sets or go to the movies, and drip by drip, the material was absorbed into their heads. By this process, could a minority win out over a majority, or to put it another way, could culture trump politics? Question, has that changed? The internet, talk radio, outlets such as Fox News, have they created openings in, for example, have they created political openings for the Bush administration that you never had when you were attempting to hold things together during Vietnam?
But there's more variety now due to the internet.
Yes.
And due to such networks as
Fox, or
as Fox News. Mm-hmm. It was almost totally uniform in the Vietnam War. Incidentally, since your audience is probably younger than I am, which is not hard to be, I think one has to point out, you keep talking about the Vietnam War as sort of our war. We inherited the Vietnam War. It had been going on for over 4 years when Nixon came in. And one of our complexities was that several of those who got us into the war then joined the peace movement.
Yes. What do you consider the beginning of the Vietnam War, of the beginning of the American involvement in Vietnam? From what moment do you date it?
Well, there was American involvement in Vietnam throughout the 50s. But we went across what we had done for other countries across the line in the Kennedy administration when we started sending, I think, 30 to 50,000 advisors there. Because when you have advisors in that magnitude for need to protect themselves, that was certainly one line. Then the next line was when President Johnson sent combat troops in 65.
Right, then it becomes explicit. You also write about a meeting that you had with Ehud Olmert, who was then the Prime Minister of Israel, who presented to you a proposal that you write about, again, in No Higher Honor. You call it remarkable and extraordinary. He's ready to offer the Palestinians 94% of the West Bank, make up for the remaining 6% with land swaps, permit them to establish a capital in East Jerusalem. And Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas refuses to entertain the offer. Well,
yeah.
So we didn't get a Palestinian
and
state.
And I have to say, I think they wish they'd taken the offer.
Do they really?
Oh, yeah.
I so think why they wish didn't they? The what is the psychology?
The psychology.
The sheer, it strikes one as sheer perversity.
Well, unfortunately, I've said to Peter, this is it seems to be one of the unluckiest processes in the world. Mm-hmm. By the time Olmert makes the offer, unfortunately, he's in political trouble. He's in legal trouble. In Israel as a result of the corruption charges.
Yes.
And we tried to, President Bush tried, I tried to prevail upon Abbas and the Palestinians to say, you have an Israeli prime minister on record as being willing to give you a capital in Jerusalem. You may never see that day again. I don't care if he's in trouble. Take it. I think there were actually Israelis who were telling them, you'll get a better deal if you wait until the elections are over. Remember also that we were close to an election in the United States. They may well have thought, well, we'll have a Democratic administration, maybe they'll be willing. It was sheer folly. It was a terrible mistake. Abbas himself has said
that. These were highly intelligent people on the Arab side who knew what they were doing, wanted a deal, but made a series of specific miscalculations.
I think that's
all. It's not a kind of sheer boneheadedness or perversity.
No, it's not. Although I did say to President Abbas, who I personally like quite a bit, I said, you know, you should have taken the deal in 48. You should have taken the deal in 67. You should have taken the deal in 2000. Now take the deal, because every time you don't take the deal, you're state gets smaller.
9/11, one would expect 9/11 to be a very recent memory. It's only a few miles in that direction down the island of Manhattan, and the entire elite opinion in New York is hard against the war in Iraq. What happened?
Well, it isn't just, first of all, the debate of are you for war or against war? It's already a terrible debate. Because nobody is for war.
Right.
There are people who think that the consequences of defeat are worse than what we're fighting, than what we're trying to fight for. So what happened in the 60s, maybe as a result in part of the assassination of President Kennedy, but when I was a young professor in the 50s at Harvard, where 99.9% of the people were Democrats, I can remember only one Republican in the faculty of Harvard that I knew. But when we had faculty meetings of people in political science, but nobody attacked the government for being a criminal activity. Nobody said this is war. They like to go to war. They are blood dripping. Sometime in the 60s. The idea developed that the government itself was an evil enterprise, that they lied professionally to the American public, and that the purpose of intellectuals was to negate the government rather than to be constructive. And that makes it very tough. Mm. Because I start from the assumption, I have now seen every administration since Eisenhower, and first of all, nobody lies deliberately to the American public. Half, 9/10 of the time, these accusations are when somebody was genuinely confused.
Right.
Secondly, everybody working in government goes through the long hours and all the other pressures, because he or she would like to make a contribution to a better world. So nobody likes to be participating in enterprises that are destructive. So when the debate gets put this way, that some evil, manipulative people get us into wars, the administration genuinely believed, so did the Clinton administration genuinely believe, that they were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. It turned out probably wrong, but it was not a deliberate lie.
Now, with that in mind, I want to remind you that Abraham Lincoln called this nation the last best hope of man on earth. Was Lincoln being arrogant?
He would be the last person to be arrogant. In the first place, at the time, the nation didn't have the power to support, I'll call it, arrogance. But Lincoln was not an arrogant person. If you look at the way he handled the nation, both before the Civil War and after the Civil War, he was not an arrogant person.
With malice toward none, charity toward all.
Exactly.
All right,
exactly.
So what
today, do we say malice toward none, charity toward all? No. We say we are the most powerful nation in the world, economically, politically, militarily. And we are. And we're going to continue to be, as far ahead as I can see, certainly for half a century. And on occasion after occasion, we demand that the world not just accept our leadership, but do as we say they should do.
So you've got a message for them, but you also have a message for us, which is the world beyond our shores is a remarkably difficult and nasty place. And it's so difficult and so nasty that one of our best friends and indispensable ally is this strangely medieval, rich with petrodollar kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
Yes, yes. But I would also say to us, the reason the United States has been so important to the international international system is that we have always been willing to deal with the world as it is.
Right.
But we've had a very strong vision of the world as it ought to be. Great powers that want to imprint a set of values on the international system, great powers that have a view of how human history ought to unfold, those are the great powers that ultimately really matter. And the United States, particularly since World War II, has had a view that as democracy spreads, as freedom spreads, even if it's in the short term difficult, in the long term it's going to be so much better. And my concern, as I sit here in 2012, is that the United States doesn't have an option to go to the sidelines and say, all right, we're done with that work of trying to make the world as it should be, not just as it is. Because one of two things will happen. Either there will be chaos, or somebody else will take up that work.
And when the British Empire collapsed, they had us to hand it over to.
That's right.
We have no one to hand it over to.
No, and the most likely outcome is that the next major imprinter on the international system is somebody who doesn't believe in a balance of power that favors freedom. And that would be very bad for us.
Build down the nuclear weapons. I quote you, the political will must be found to undertake a process of radical, rapid denuclearization. President Bush has proposed dramatic reductions in our nuclear forces. The right move?
I endorse that wholeheartedly.
But
let me just take 30 seconds to say where we are today. As we speak, in the U.S., we have 7,500 strategic nuclear warheads, in a sense directed against Russia. Each one on average 20 times the kill capability of the Hiroshima bomb, which killed 200,000 people. Of the 7,500, 2,500 are on 15-minute alert to be launched on warning. Those in your audience who saw President Bush inaugurated, saw him put his hand on the Bible, swear his oath. Then there was a little milling around because many of the people were going inside the Capitol for lunch. And while the milling around took place, a blue-suited officer stepped behind President Bush. He carried the football. He carried the briefcase that carries the electronic codes without which our nuclear warheads cannot be armed. And that briefcase has to be within arm's length of the president 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, because he may arm them and may launch them. 2,500 on 15-minute alert with a kill capability, 50,000 times that of their shooting amount. It's insane. Now, he, to his great credit, has said, he didn't quite use the word insane, but he said, in effect, we've got to move out of this. And therefore, he says, I think we can move unilaterally. Now, he hadn't said to what level, but he's implied perhaps to taking down from 7,500 to something on the order of 2,500 or 1,500. I strongly applaud that. And in addition, with reference to this 2,500 on 15-minute, I'll call it hair trigger alert, he said we've got to reduce the alert status, and it ought to be done preferably by separating warheads from the launch vehicles. So those two moves I strongly support. It'll take us, if we were to start tomorrow, it'd take us 5 years to implement that. At the end of that time, we ought to think about the next moves, and ultimately, I would favor elimination or near elimination, you know, 5 or 10 or 15, we won't argue about that, but essentially eliminating the risk of destruction of societies, really the risk of destruction of civilization.
Final question. Henry Luce famously called the 20th century the American century. What's your feeling about the 21st? Is this another American century, or do we find ourselves in the position of Britain toward the end of the 19th century, in which our dominance is fading?
It can be the American. It can be a century in which we play a major role. But we have to understand our capacities, but we also have to understand our limits. We cannot think that we can redo the whole world. But we should be able to protect free peoples against dangers and prevent a balance of forces to evolve that is very hostile to us. But it requires, first, a more continuing approach to foreign policy than has been characteristic of America historically.
Right.
Secondly, a clearer vision of what the American role is, something between isolationism and the world crusade. And it requires leadership groups that educate themselves on the substance of foreign policy. I mean, we keep getting be told it makes no difference what anyone knows. They can learn it on the job. On the job in Washington, you can't learn. You can use up your substance, but it's very hard to acquire it.
So you felt in those first moments, again, you mentioned physical security. It wasn't the physical security of the nation. You felt everybody in the White House itself felt physically exposed.
Well, we knew we were physically exposed, but you didn't have time to think about that. You only had to think about the nation. And it's very funny, Peter, you mentioned in the intro that I had been on the White House staff as the Soviet specialist.
Right.
And of course, in those days, everybody prepared for the possibility of the unthinkable nuclear war. What would you do if the United States was about to experience that decapitating attack? And almost immediately, those impulses kicked in for me on September
11th. Oh, really?
Yes. And so I went to the bunker. The vice president was there, and he was on the phone with the president getting an unimaginable order to have the Air Force shoot down a civilian aircraft that was not responding. Because, after all, civilian aircraft had now all become potential missiles against the country. And the first thing that I thought was to get in touch with Vladimir Putin and to make sure that the Russians understood that our military forces would be going up on alert so that we didn't get into what was called in the old days a spiral of alerts between the two military forces. And I and Putin was actually on the phone trying to reach President Bush, and so I got on with him. I said, the president is not available. He's going to an undisclosed location. But I want you to know our military forces are going on alert. He said, I know ours are coming down. And is there anything else we can do? And I thought, wow, the Cold War really is over. And the other thing that I did was to have the State Department send out a cable to every post in the world to say the United States of America has not been decapitated. We are functioning. And you wanted friend and foe to know that we were not suddenly vulnerable.
The United States, under this imperative, the United States will not apply its economic, political, or military power unilaterally, other than in the unlikely circumstances of a defense of the continental United States, Hawaii, and Alaska. Okay, that's your statement. Now,
that's correct.
October 1973, first week of the Israeli-Arab War, goes very badly for Israel, and Richard Nixon, acting unilaterally, I believe he had some support from the Portuguese, but it was essentially a unilateral American action, told the Soviets not to interfere and resupplied the Israelis and very likely saved the state of Israel. Would you really want us to bind ourselves to multilateral action such that we could not engage in an action like that ever again?
You either don't know or have forgotten some of your history.
All right, fill me in.
Nixon didn't do that for the first time. In June of 67, the hotline was used for the first time. I was secretary at the time. Johnson was president.
Kosygin, you have the advantage of not only knowing your history, but having lived it. Go ahead.
Kosygin, in the exchange of messages, first use of the hotline, one of the messages said, if you want war, you'll get war. Now, why did that kind of a message come? Because the Egyptians were absolutely intent on literally eliminating Israel as a state in the world. They were going to destroy Israel. Israel knew that. Israel preempted. They knocked the hell out of the Egyptians. Then the Egyptians lied, literally. Nasser, a year later, told Life magazine he had lied. He called King Hussein of Jordan and said, the American carrier in the Sixth Fleet is bombing Cairo, and you, Hussein and Jordan, have got to come in and help us. So Hussein came in, attacked Israel, and Israel knocked the hell out of Hussein. So then we're left with Syria and Russia. And we were concerned that Russia would support Syria and attack Israel. So unilaterally, we moved the fleet back toward, it was steaming west, we moved it steaming east to help protect Israel. That was a unilateral action. There are exceptions to every rule. I don't want to say there aren't. But generally speaking, we should lead. All right. We should not apply our
power. But you would not forswear.
Oh, there are all certain right. circumstances.
Okay.
You were national security advisor through the first term. You're in charge of the councils of war, so to speak. And I'm a layman out here in California. It looked to me the way it looked to a lot of people. Don Rumsfeld at the Pentagon seems to be at sideways of Secretary Powell at the State Department. You've got the CIA. The CIA, I wrote this down, I was so struck. 2003, Daniel Dresner of the New Republic wrote, the CIA is in open revolt. Why did it seem, first of all, what's the substance? Was there dysfunction that ought not to have taken place? Is this simply the kind of thing that you expect when the whole world is being reinvented, when all the assumptions and administration? How do we, again, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Tenet, all these people have their own memoirs out. Some of the passages are a little testy. People still feel a little raw about it. I don't care about that. What's the lesson?
The lesson is that in hard times, personalities will become more what they are, not less what they are. And we had real substantive differences. Mm-hmm. The fact is people had different views of how some of this ought to be proceeding. But I think it's a bit of an overstatement to say that the State Department was off doing its own thing in defense. No, the Defense Department had responsibility for post-war reconstruction because the president wanted a single chain of command, unity of command between the military forces and what was going on the civilian side. And so through the Coalition Provisional Authority under Jerry Bremer, reporting up to Don Rumsfeld and the military chain reporting up to Don Rumsfeld, the Pentagon had responsibility for this. Now, to be fair to the Pentagon, I don't think anybody had ever undertaken a rebuilding of this magnitude. And the real lesson is, and we got it right by the time of the surge, there are really a couple of lessons. The first is we simply didn't have enough forces on the ground. Mm-hmm. And so all of the chaos that breaks out shortly after the statue comes down makes it difficult to do even the simplest task of reconstruction. And we simply didn't have enough forces. Secondly, I think it was a bit of an intelligence problem. Mm-hmm. We did not really fundamentally understand the tribal structures in Iraq. we could have made much better use of the tribes. We could have built Iraq from the outside in instead of from the inside out in the provinces. And the kind of thing that happened with the Anbar Awakening then in 2005 when we made common cause with the sheikhs and really started to get this on a better footing, perhaps that could have happened earlier. But war is like that. As someone said, when you go to war, plans have a tendency to go out of the window, and you're inventing on the ground.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson. To all our viewers, happy 4th of July.